Welcome. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, Professor and Chairman of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, New York Presbyterian Hospital, and I'd like to welcome you to How to Save Your Life. This week, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Gerald M. Laughlin, the Nancy C. Paduano Professor and Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Weill Medical College of Cornell University and New York Presbyterian Hospital. Today, we are going to talk about a topic of great interest concerning your child's health. Many of you have been frightened by your child saying, "Mom, Dad, I can't breathe." Dr. Laughlin will help you save your child's life. Stay tuned. Hello, and welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and today I'm talking with Dr. Gerald Loughlin, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Weill Medical College, Cornell University. Jerry, welcome.
Thanks, Phil.
Many people are probably wondering out there, what does being a pediatrician mean? What do you all cover?
That's a very interesting question. We cover babies from the moment they're born till kids basically graduate from college and get married. So we have this long period of time where we're responsible for children.
So really, you follow them, I always thought it was 18. You follow them out to 22, huh?
Yeah, the American Academy of Pediatrics has said that they think that pediatrics kind of ends at 22 when they graduate from college. Although there are some people that actually we're dealing with kids with chronic illnesses where the pediatricians may actually follow them into later adulthood because the pediatricians have become the experts in the disease. Good example would be cystic fibrosis, where for years children died very early in life. And with improvements in care, kids were now living to their 20s and 30s and 40s. And the only people who knew anything about the disease were the pediatricians. So that's been an interesting problem of transitioning care of children to adulthood because the conditions have persisted. But generally, around the age of when kids start to get out of college is the time that they're transitioned to the adult services.
This is terrible news. I keep threatening my children that I'm going to stop supporting them at 18.
As a father of older children, you never stop supporting them.
For those of you listening, Dr. Loughlin is a world's expert on pediatric pulmonary diseases, which are diseases of the lung. What kind of problems do you deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Well, probably the biggest one we deal with and most common pulmonary problem is asthma. In addition, there are a wide variety of chronic conditions. The lung tends to be what we call a shock organ. It's an innocent bystander, so many other conditions result in secondary damage to the lungs. Treatment of children with cancer, treatment of children with a variety of gastrointestinal disorders. The lung can wind up being injured inadvertently. The other big area that we focus on is the issue of children with sleep and breathing problems. We have, over the last several decades, become increasingly aware that breathing when a child is asleep and breathing when they're awake are two entirely different processes. And so we know that there are kids with sleep apnea, there are kids who are at risk of sudden infant death syndrome, so we've actually followed a variety of children with sleep disorders as well.
Well, let's take it, we're all getting our kids ready for school, and the ragweed and hayweed season is all coming up. What is asthma, and how can we protect our kids from it?
Okay, well, asthma is a chronic condition affecting the lungs, and it's associated with having trouble breathing. Probably that's the simplest thing, and that children and adults feel like they can't get the air in and out of their lungs very easily. It's a pretty frightening thing not to be able to breathe. It's manifested primarily, in addition to this kind of shortness of breath, by wheezing, a whistling noise that people will hear. It is a very common problem. There may be up to 10% of kids affected with asthma. And it can start very early and continue on into adulthood. So the seeds of asthma in adults are often sown in childhood. It's an interesting problem when you look at what sets it off. Probably the most common trigger is viral infections, the common cold. Mm-hmm. And the average American kid gets about 6 colds a year. If they happen to be an overachiever, they'll get a few more. But what'll happen in the child with asthma is they get a cold, runs its usual 3 to 5 days, and normally the cold goes away, but then what happens is that sets up the asthma symptoms to continue and persist, and that's when we start to see difficulty. The other big triggers are, as you mentioned, allergy is a problem, and it can be a variety of things. The seasonal pollen allergies, whether it's the spring pollens when the flowers and the grass are blooming, or in the fall with the ragweed and those in the fall pollens. We also see other environmental allergens. House dust is a big problem. It's the house dust mite that's in the bed clothing is the thing that sets people off. Children with food allergies, an increasing problem as we go on, milk and peanuts and those kinds of things. The other two very important triggers as we head into this fall season are exercise and cold air. Mm-hmm. And they gang up. they cause problems. They're called additive problems. So we'll have children who can exercise fairly well during the summer months, but when the temperature drops in the fall, that's when we start to see them having increasing difficulty with exercise. And it's also a problem that's sports related too. So baseball players rarely have problems with asthma because they do a lot of standing around watching things going on. But the sports that are associated with endurance, so soccer, lacrosse, full court basketball, are the ones that really get kids going, and it can be a significant problem when you're out running up and down the court. If you're the one that starts to have an asthma episode and everybody else is functioning just fine, it's going to pull you out of the game because you can't keep going at that pace. It's interesting that some sports are actually pretty good for asthma. Swimming has historically been a very good sport, probably because the environment that the kids participate in is warmer and there's more humidity in the pools. Although even the pools aren't safe because of the chlorine. I don't know whether you've ever been in an indoor pool. You walk inside and you can almost taste the chlorine in the air. And it's kind of I think it's a public health thing that people think, well, if a little chlorine is good, a lot must be better. And they'll dump it in there and it comes out and it leaches out into the air. And that acts as kind of an irritant to the breathing passages and will make some of the kids wheeze with swimming. But generally where we see it are the endurance sports outside, you know, the ones that occur during the cold weather. Now, the good news is we can control this. So there are kids who are having exercise-related symptoms. We have things to control that. There are medications that can be taken before. We can prepare them better for exercise, get them into better shape. The other big trigger for asthma episodes is smoking. Now, you'd say, well, pediatrics smoking. Well, it's not so much that the kids are smoking, but it's the people around them. So environmental tobacco smoke, exposure to cigarette smoke is a big issue. And
is that a growing problem or is it reducing?
Well, you know, it's surprising. Even in this day and age, tobacco smoke is still pretty common. And, you know, there's still 20 plus percent of the population smokes. And there seems to be this almost perverse thing where the kids with asthma turn out to be around smoking adults and it sets them off. So
do you find in the pediatric population, these 18 to 20 year olds, is that smoking population increasing or decreasing?
It stayed fairly constant, but it's still 20% of somebody estimated that around 20% of graduating high school seniors will smoke. The scary part that is if you look at adult smokers, more than 80% of them start smoking before the age of 18. So this is a pediatric public health issue. And if we want to have any impact on adult smoking, it's really focusing on the kids. That's also as an interesting sidebar. You know, if you look at the kids graduating from high school today, have since the day they entered school had anti-smoking education as part of their health curriculum. And we've had a very small impact on getting kids to stop smoking or not start smoking. Some of that may be because they're around parents who smoke.
It brings up we're physicians and people keep walking up to me and asking me these general questions. I'm not that smart like you. These general questions about asthma, is there any genetic component to it or is it all environmental?
No, there's definitely a genetic component. It falls into the category of what we call complex genetic disorders because there's multi facets that contribute to it. But clearly there's an inheritance pattern so that children...
So if I have asthma, my kids need to worry about it.
It's very likely that they'll be at risk. Now, that's where the environmental things get into the play. It may be certain exposures during early childhood or at a critical time in childhood may set you up. So if you could avoid those exposures or you miss them, you may be able to get away without developing it. We also know that children... There are a group of children that'll have symptoms early in life, under the age of 5 or 6, and then after that, they magically settle down and go away and seem to be okay. At least they don't seem to develop problems. As kids have had asthma, as they live out their lives and they take on adult jobs, whether it may be occupational exposures or increasing allergy exposure, they may come back again. And we see adults showing up with asthma, and they were kids with asthma as well. So there's some genetic component, but it hasn't quite been defined yet what exactly the gene is. There isn't an asthma gene that's been specifically identified. Yeah.
We'll get into the problem of obesity a little bit later, but you know, the one thing that you were talking about earlier, is this exercise-induced asthma? I mean, does that mean that a child that has asthma can't play soccer, can't play basketball? What are you going to do for mom and dad so that they can have a kid that gets out there and plays?
That's actually a great question, because a lot of times people feel that that's a problem, that they may they have to sit on the sidelines, and that's absolutely not the case. We've generally been able to, with some of the modern medications, there are bronchodilator medicines. Those are medicines that open up the airways and will prevent episodes. We rarely restrict a child from sports. We get them out there and play. In many instances, we're able to allow them to compete. I've taken care of, you know, world-class soccer players and basketball players who have had asthma and who were able to function just nicely with appropriate training and conditioning, and then with the appropriate use of the medications to treat them. We occasionally will recommend sports to people. So if somebody's having a lot of trouble it's an outdoor sport like cross-country skiing, we might say to them, look, there are other alternatives to this. We've also we've taken care of patients. When I was in Baltimore before, we took care of patients in the from the Naval Academy. So we had a variety of people who would, kids with asthma, went into the Naval Academy. And if you talk about a stressful, you know, strenuous period, that's first year of the Naval Academy. And we worked with them to help them get through even that very rigorous training.
Have you found anybody limited in their life because of asthma?
Oh, there are some. Yes. Yeah. There's a spectrum of illness, from people that have very mild symptoms to some that are very sick and debilitated by it. And fortunately, that's a small percentage of the population.
I'm interested about this, again, the exercise-induced asthma. Is it something you're predisposed to, or is it something you can do before you exercise to avoid having an asthmatic episode? Yeah.
Yes, there are things you can do to avoid it. The most common thing you can do is take a medication, a bronchodilator drug, which is a drug that relaxes the muscle in the airway, keeps it from constricting, because that's what sets off the acute asthma episode. It's kind of like having a clamp around the airway. What happens when you start to have an asthma episode, it constricts it down and narrows the breathing tube so that you can't get air in and out. So you can take medications before. Conditioning is important. So if you're going to be in the really competitive sports, we've got to make sure you're in good condition. And then sometimes what we can do, asthma is kind of a funny thing. So if we can do a lot of preparation before, we can actually minimize some of the symptoms that'll occur with strenuous exercise. And I said, occasionally we've had to recommend people consider other sports, especially as they move up the food chain and the sports become increasingly competitive. If we don't have great control over their symptoms, they're competing with people whose lungs and hearts are working perfectly fine. It's hard to remain competitive at the college and above level.
Absolutely. Time to take a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll have more with Dr. Gerald Laughlin, the Nancy C. Paduano Professor and Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you are listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Gerald Laughlin, the professor and chairman of pediatrics at Weill Medical College, Cornell University. Before, we were talking a little bit about exercise-induced asthma, and as a parent, I would feel terrible if I sent my kid out there and he or she had an asthmatic attack and something devastating happened. How closely do we need to be linked to our pediatrician when our child has this problem?
Well, I think it's important for parents to recognize that when a child is out there exercising, if they notice that they're not keeping up, that they're falling off or they're coming over to the sidelines having trouble breathing, that it's in the old days, when we were all growing up, people would think we were malingering. We were trying to get out of having to work hard and find a way out. But in actuality, what's happened is the kids want to play. They want to be out there. And I think it's important that if you notice that your child is not keeping up, to talk to the pediatrician about whether or not this exercise-induced asthma may be a factor contributing to their trouble. Fortunately, it's not something that in most instances is going to cause a severe life-threatening episode. Most times what happens is that because it limits your ability to breathe and exercise, what you do is you back off. And if you back off, that will frequently minimize the episode. So we're able to get through it pretty easily.
Okay. Well, we're all getting our kids ready for the school year now and the school shopping and making our appointments with the pediatrician. You know, my wife does all this. I'm totally unaware of what happens. Please explain to the male audience what the mothers are doing for our children out there.
Well, it depends on the age of the child. The younger kids, and especially as you enter into school, there's a required school physical, and that's probably the thing that's been done probably earlier in the summer, because most of the schools now require that the immunizations be up to date, and that's a particularly important area because a lot of school districts will not allow the children to go into first grade or kindergarten unless they can prove that they've had their required panel of immunizations. The other area where that I think the school becomes and preparing for school as the college age kids. And that sounds kind of funny because you think they're going to be independent. But as you think about it, they have been kind of under mom and dad's watchful eye for 18 years. And now suddenly they're on their own at some college campus. You're depending upon a school health service. So I think it's really important that, in particular, if a child has a chronic condition, that the parents and the child start to prepare them that they're now going to be the ones that are responsible. So they have to recognize when they're having trouble. They have to remember to take their medicines in the appropriate time frame that mom usually has been reminding him, you know, Jimmy, did you take your pill today? You know, that won't happen now because Jimmy's now off at Princeton, Yale or whatever. So I think it's really important to prepare the child for this transition that they are now assuming responsibility for their illnesses, which is an important part of growing up.
How hard is that?
It can be a challenge, especially if the parents have played a major role in managing the condition, to all of a sudden expect the kid to do this. It can be a big deal. My daughters were away in college, and the issue of the student health service was kind of this notorious place that when they'd call us and say they were sick, we'd say, well, go to the student health service. And, you know, they would go, oh, God, anything but the student health service. You know, so I think a lot of student health services have gotten a bad reputation. But it is important that there be appropriate arrangements made, that hopefully nothing's going to happen. But if the child needs help, that they're able to find appropriate medical supervision.
You talked earlier about immunizations. I mean, can you just briefly outline what are the appropriate times for immunizations and what do parents need to make sure their kids have been immunized for?
Right now, it is one of the most complicated issues. The number of immunizations has grown dramatically. There's a series that starts, and I would, I'll have to be really honest, I don't have it all down. There's a chart that's published by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and we can get out. But it starts when the babies, right now babies are getting immunized basically in the newborn nursery. They get some of the first shots right. That's a big difference than when we were born. They get protection against hepatitis. Then they get the usual ones that we all had, which was diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, and polio at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. Then there are other vaccines that are in this, protection against Haemophilus influenza. That was an important cause of a condition called epiglottitis, which was a swelling of the upper airway and used to be a life-threatening emergency for kids. that has virtually gone away because of this immunization. Now there are immunizations against pneumococcus, which is a cause of pneumonia and meningitis. That gets thrown into the mix.
Pneumococcus being a
bacteria that causes pneumonia, yeah, and very severe pneumonia, and meningitis, which is an infection in the brain. There are now other ones against varicella, which is chickenpox. So all of these immunizations are coming out. It's a very elaborate schedule that you really have to work with your pediatrician and time it right through the childhood years.
Yesterday, there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine about vaccination for measles. Again, apparently some child went to Romania and introduced a series of measles somewhere. Do you have to be vaccinated for that anymore?
Yeah, measles is one of the ones that measles, mumps, rubella, the MMR, is very important. One of the things that's occurring as we see with these immunizations is that the immunity in a number of instances, the protection against the infection, may not be lifelong. So that what we're finding is both in college age kids and more importantly in parents, and you and I were talking a few minutes ago, that the parents are getting, when they get exposed to their kids, they may get some of these illnesses because their immunity is not protective anymore, particularly in the geriatric population. It's a big challenge for grandparents because, you know, a 60, 70-year-old grandparent may not have seen any of these illnesses for a long time. Their immune response may be not quite as vigorous as it was, and now they're with grandkids, right, and they're getting exposed to a variety of these illnesses. So it can be a challenge.
That was going to be my next question. Is I remember distinctly spending half of the first part of the school year sick from my kids bringing home infections, and they were running around fine. Is there anything I can do, you know, to protect myself, or just wait till it happens and, you know, take the cold medication over the counter?
Right. Probably the most important thing anybody can do is hand washing. As you know, in a hospital, it is one of our top priorities right now. Even at home, it's hand washing, because the viruses that you probably got, interestingly, stay alive on surfaces for hours after somebody has touched them. So if someone has a virus like what's called RSV, which is a very common cause of breathing problems in young kids, RSV could live on this tabletop for 3 to 4 hours or so. So I've got
RSV is a type of virus.
A type of virus, yeah. So the RSV virus, I've got it. I touch this tabletop and I walk away. And then you come in, you touch the tabletop. You now have been exposed to the RSV virus. You didn't know it. In fact, you weren't even around anybody who seemed sick. So there are issues like that. So good hand washing, particularly before you're going to eat or do anything, is really essential. These Purell dispensers that we see everywhere. But I think that would be the most important thing. I think there's just there may be a benefit to being around the kids, in that it'll goose your immunity again, and you'll get less illnesses later on.
With the younger child population, it's we're defenseless in the sense that they're going to get exposed to it. And for people with older children, we had been talking about it a little bit earlier, the impact of smoking on asthma. You know, how do we, as parents, try to help protect our kids from some of these common pediatric problems? Like, you know, a major issue, as you said, 20% of the population still smokes. What can we do as a parent, other than not smoke in front of them, to try to help them not do that?
Yeah, role modeling is very important, because it does, when you look at the data, there's a strong relationship. If the parents are smoking and it seems to be an acceptable behavior within the family, it's the kids are not, they figure, hey, well, if mom and dad can do it, what about me? I think it's really important from the very beginning. Now, if you were my father, you could get in serious trouble if he ever saw you even looking at a cigarette. So there is an issue of you can't really threaten the kids, but I think you can continually advise about the negative aspects of smoking and just make it part of the family lore that this is not a good thing to do. It's really interesting. It's hard to scare kids, you know, because if I say to you, oh, you know, you're going to grow up, whatever, they're going to say, well, Dad, that's ridiculous.
You know? Is there any data on secondhand smoke and the impact, you know, on asthma, lung cancer, other diseases?
Oh, yeah, there's an increasing body of knowledge. That's why, as a society, it's amazing to me that we still tolerate it. When you look at the data that comes out in terms of not only the primary effects on the smoker, but the people around them, there are increasing reports of spouses, of people who had been long-term smokers developing lung cancer. So you see women developing lung cancer who've never picked up a cigarette, but their husbands had been, you know, two-pack-a-day people for 10, 20 years. Clearly, it's a trigger for asthma episodes. It's associated with increased respiratory infections, ear infections, colds in kids of parents who smoke. And then the effects begin prenatally, too, so that we know that a woman who smokes during pregnancy, babies are smaller. They have increased rates of problems where the babies are born prematurely and a whole lot of other problems associated with that. Their lungs are smaller at birth and don't grow as well afterwards. So this is a very powerful negative effect on the human system. And for some reason or another, it shows you the economic impact of the tobacco industry.
If a child starts to smoke early in age, 14 years old, aside from the obvious impact with asthma and on the lungs, is there another impact on bone growth, development of their menstrual cycle in girls or maturation in boys?
I'm not aware of that at all. The problems really do seem to be related to the risk. It increases their risk of cancer. No one really knows when it is that you suddenly start cancer from smoking cigarettes. But obviously, the longer you go, and if you start at 14, you got a lot of years ahead of you, hopefully. It also is an incredible risk factor for developing of emphysema and chronic obstructive lung disease in adults. And so we've got people in their 40s and 50s who can't walk up a flight of stairs without being short of breath, direct effect of exposure to cigarette smoking.
Let's talk about another major healthcare problem that President Nixon, 30 years ago, was interested in when he had that whole physical fitness thing with George Allen, but it's the problem of obesity. Where are we going with that, and what is the problem?
The problem, and no pun intended, the problem is huge. Obesity is really at epidemic proportions in our population. There's a wonderful display that a couple of our faculty have shown me where you look at the percentage of the population who's BMI, body mass index, which is a measure of your obesity, looking at states that had a certain percentage of their population who were considered obese. And if you chart that over the last 20 years, virtually the entire country has filled in where states have significant percentage of their population who are considered obese. There's several factors contribute to it. One is the supersizing. You look at the quarter pounder with cheese, French fries, and a Coke. That's 1,000 calories right there, probably maybe even more. So people are eating too much. Our portion size is just out of proportion. We also have kind of a sedentary society. So if you look at kids, they watch TV more. They are in front of the computer more. Whereas when we were growing up, my mother kicked us out of the house all the time. So we were out playing. We were out running around. And nowadays, kids are much more sedentary. So if you take in more calories, it's a pretty simple equation. If you take in more calories than you expend, you're going to get overweight and get fat. So we're seeing in certain populations, this problem is a severe epidemic. In New York City, the Hispanic population has that's been a problem with obesity, and then also a condition called type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes used to be called adult onset diabetes, because this is the diabetes that grandmother got or grandfather got when they got to be 50 and 60 and their pancreas was a little burned out and they may be eating too much. Now we're seeing it in teenagers and younger. So it's no longer adult onset diabetes. It's now referred to as type 2, and it's directly related to obesity.
So again, just like in asthma, is this both environmental, behavioral, and genetic, or no genetics involved?
No, genetics are clearly involved. And the genetics is, again, it's complex because it may well be genes that control behavior and genes that control eating. We know that the genetics can control those kinds of activities. So it could be that you put somebody who's got a gene that wants them to eat a lot or consume a lot in, and is also becomes a sedentary person. That combination could be what'll trigger. Clearly, the exposure to what we expose kids to in terms of portion size, and you read on a package of potato chips and it says a serving size is X. That's, no one's ever really validated what a serving size is. It's what the company will get you to, will help you buy two bags of potato chips instead of one. So it's their environmental issues, their behavioral family issues. Because again, if the parents are overweight, the kids are also likely to wind up being overweight as well.
So there we have the problem. If the parents are overweight, they're not going to notice the child being overweight. And it's a self-perpetuating issue.
Yes, that's exactly right. Our residents in our pediatric clinic had done a study a year or so ago where they asked parents whether the the child was obese or overweight. And we knew what their BMI was. We knew what their body mass index was and where they fell. And it was surprising how many parents said, no, the kid's just fine. When we explored that more deeply, we found there were cultural issues. There are certain populations where being overweight is a sign of wealth and affluence and that you're doing very well. So if you're skinny, that means the family's not doing so good. So you don't want skinny kids around because the neighbors will think you're very poor. So you have to deal with those cultural issues as well.
So you know, as a grotesque example of this, I remember as a medical student, a patient was in his bed and the bed collapsed and they had to call the fire department with a special hoist to bring the patient in. He was 600 pounds, required two hospital beds to hold this patient. And the sad part was is that his mother, in order to make it easy for him to eat, moved the refrigerator next to his bed. You know, what do pediatricians do? I mean, you see the child come in your office. You see that their body mass index is high. You look at mom and dad. You just said that there's this cycle. What can we do as doctors and as a society to try to help change this?
Well, I think it's really important. We have several roles. One on the just dealing with the patient and family. I think in the past we focused on the child. Said, okay, this child needs to lose weight, and kind of ignored the fact that everyone else in the family was overweight. So one of the newer strategies is to focus on better nutrition for the family. So this has to become a family issue. It's not just little Susie or Jimmy who has to lose weight. Everybody's got to commit to this. The other thing is just the awareness of what people are eating, and so there can be tremendous value in having people write down what they eat. And then look back on it, and all of a sudden people realize, wow, I didn't realize that that quarter pounder had 900 calories and it's 30% fat or whatever it is. So getting people aware of it is also important. I think as pediatricians, one of our major roles is to advocate for kids. Kids don't vote frequently. Their parents may not vote or they may not have a lot of resources. So I think this is where, as a society, we need to advocate working with the food industry to work on this issue of portion size. Important thing is the schools, that many of the schools, a revenue stream for many of the public schools were the soda machines and candy machines in the school. So where does a kid go if he, rather than eating a healthy sandwich that maybe mom sent with him or he could buy, you can go and buy Twinkies and a Coke. And it's just easy to do. So the schools, you have to get those out of the school system. But it's an interesting issue because it's a loss of revenue for the schools that they might use to support an after-school program. So they're.
Does that make your life more complex, the fact that you've got to deal not only with the child's disease, but mom and dad's emotional component related to it?
Yes, it makes it very complicated because everything we do has to factor in the family. And it's a focus of pediatrics right now, which is really family-centered care. You have to look at the whole family dynamics, regardless of what condition you're going to treat, whether it's asthma or obesity or diabetes, you have to deal with the family.
So family-centered care, is that a new concept?
It's something that people have thought about for a while. It's probably a new label. People have thought about it for a while, and it's now kind of a focus area for many both hospitals and outpatient areas, is because we looked at why we weren't getting control of certain issues, and it was because we had people that were outside the loop, you know, in terms of our treatment plan.
Great. It's time to take a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll have more with Dr. Gerald Laughlin, the Nancy C. Padvano Professor and Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you are listening to How to Save Your Life.
Thank you.
Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Gerald Laughlin. It's been a distinct pleasure to have Dr. Laughlin here and speak to him about pulmonary disease and pediatrics. Dr. Laughlin is one of the world-famous pediatricians and certainly recognized as a world leader in the management of pulmonary disease. He received his medical degree from the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, and did a pulmonary fellowship at the University of Arizona. Thereafter, he went to the University of Florida and moved subsequently to the Johns Hopkins Medical Center, where he formed the leading pulmonary center in the country. They were fortunate enough to recruit him away to Weill Cornell Medical Center to become the professor and chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at that institution, and it's a distinct pleasure to have him here. Jerry, what made you become a pediatrician?
You know, Phil, people have asked me that question, and I'm not quite sure. Some of it may be that I was one of six kids, and we grew up in an apartment in New York City, a three-bedroom apartment. So I guess I was around children a lot. I was the oldest of the boys in that crowd. I think that I've always found kids kind of fun to be with, and I always wanted to have something to do to help people, and the kids were kind of fun to be around. So the challenges are great. You deal with little babies right up, as I said earlier, up to teenagers going to college. So it's never dull. And I think they're just kind of fun, exciting. From a kind of intellectual academic standpoint, you deal with this whole concept of development, which is so fascinating. You start with a baby who does virtually nothing and wind up at the age 18 with somebody who's going off to college and can drive a car and do all of these things. So we get to participate in that process. And I've always found it kind of interesting.
It's funny, when I was thinking about what I was going to do when I grew up, I actually thought about being a pediatric psychiatrist. And my reason... the audience should know that that during this entire interview, it's been this distinct pleasure to have Dr. Laughlin smiling. He's a happy pediatrician. And one of the reasons I thought about pediatric psychiatry was that, you know, you could help children and then they'd go on to lead a normal life. You know, just the longevity of your ability to help somebody, is that something that really attracts you and motivates you every morning?
Yeah, it is. And there's also a part of it that I don't often admit in public, and that is that many pediatricians, the general pediatricians, which are absolutely the backbone of the practice, most kids are fortunately, thank God, healthy. And so they don't get into a lot of trouble. They don't get very sick. I realized I had a certain character flaw, which was that I needed to be around people that were sick and in need. And so that's how I wound up doing lung disease, because there's a certain acuteness to it that when kids get sick and they can't breathe, you have to deal with the issue right away. It can't be postponed. You can't wait 6 weeks or whatever. And I realized that in my own personality, that kind of urgency was going to be an important part to keep me in the game. And over the last 20-something years doing pulmonary disease, it's certainly been that.
Is there a change in the world of pediatrics? I mean, I think it's admirable that you have that quality of wanting to deal with critical disease. But as you said, most pediatricians are dealing with normally healthy kids. Are different kinds of people going into pediatrics now than 20 years ago? Do they have different life expectations?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've all seen that in medicine. There's been a change. Clearly one of the biggest changes, and I think pediatrics and probably obstetrics are right up there, is the gender issue. We're approaching probably 60 to 70% of the pediatric workforce are women, which creates all sorts of interesting challenges, not only for the discipline of pediatrics, but also for those pediatricians. As you know, after the years of training, medical school and residency and fellowship, there are tremendous pressures about how do you fit a family into the demands of a career in medicine. So we're having to deal with that as we set up our faculty practice and our faculty as well. We have part-time people, so we do job sharing. We've been very creative about that in our program. So we have people that work a couple of days a week and other people that pick up for the other parts of the week. And it's just a necessity to accommodate the demands of being a mother and raising kids.
How do the patients respond to that? You know, one day they come in and, you know, it's Dr. Laughlin. The next day they come in and it's another pediatrician.
They seem to do well. I think the important part, the thing that makes that work, is the transfer of information. Again, this is an area that you and I have focused on in the hospital, is to make sure that I don't walk in and say, well, who are you? That if I walk in and I know who you are because my colleague has given me the appropriate information. They seem to do pretty well with that.
Something we had talked or touched upon a little bit earlier, you were talking about the differences in dealing with, you know, the young child getting ready for school. I wanted to touch upon the stresses and strains of being a parent of a teen. You know, both my children are now in their teens, and the usual answer to my question is whatever. But the major problems that we worry about, alcohol and binge drinking, concepts of date rape and unprotected sex. Those are meaty topics. Why don't we talk a little bit about, my kid getting ready for college? Yeah. I'm worried about drinking too much and either suicide or something related to alcohol. What are the issues?
There are several issues. One, just before I get into that, as you were saying that, frequently when I sit with parents and they ask about how risky something is or how dangerous a condition is, the pinnacle of anxiety and stress for parents, I figured out, is the first night that you hand the child the car keys and they're going to drive by themselves. So everything else pales in proportion to that event, and you have this to look forward to, especially with your kids driving in New York City. So these are big issues, and I think it's very important, as with everything else, that the parents talk about these conditions before the kid leaves. I think many times we just either we're uncomfortable talking about them to these young adolescents or old adolescents, and so we don't bring them up. And then the kid gets to college, and all of a sudden they're in a fraternity house or a dorm, and there's booze around and stuff. And unfortunately for our adolescents and young adults, these are significant health risks. Binge drinking, you just have to watch the evening news, and there are the numbers of deaths every year on college campuses from kids who binge drink is extraordinary and is on the rise. I grew up in a family where, being an Irish Catholic family, abstinence was not part of the deal there in terms of having a beer from now and then. But there was always moderation taught, so my father had no problem sitting down having a beer, but you're not going to have 10 beers. And so when we got away to college, having a beer wasn't a big deal because we had kind of been through that and had been given the responsible approach to it. I think for a lot of kids, it's the first time they're away from home. No one's ever said anything to them, and bingo, they're out there and they're around. And so I think it's really important before they go away to warn them. The issue of date rape and this drug thing, again, is another pretty scary thing for families. And I think it's, again, very important for parents, particularly of daughters, to make sure that they're aware that there are some people out there that are not so nice. And to
you just have to read the front page of the Post, and I won't admit to being a regular Post reader. However, it's a terribly sad thing to see the number of times that these terrible things happen to young ladies. And we had talked about this earlier. You mentioned that there are some drugs that somebody could slip your child.
Yeah.
And can you go into that a little bit?
It's the date rape drug, and I must admit, I'm not kind of up on what the exact name is, but people, the kind of vernacular is the date rape drug. And it's a drug that's, you can't taste it, it's odorless, whatever, and it's easy for someone to slip it in your drink. And so you talk to kids about making sure that somebody just says, let me go buy you a drink or bring it to you. You want to make sure that you have control over that. If you leave the table, that you don't just, because even somebody that you trust, if you're the first time you met him, could be the problem. So I think it's just kind of, you don't want people to live in fear, and you don't want them to be totally say, I'm never going to go out and do this thing. But I think kind of awareness of the fact that this is a problem out there, and that if there are going to be in a social setting where alcohol is involved, that they don't that's where the overdoing it becomes a problem. If you have too much, you kind of lose control over a situation, and then you're much more vulnerable to all of these situations.
And we also know that the incidence of severe head and spine trauma is also related to alcohol consumption and just trying to keep them away from the steering wheel.
That's exactly right. A big issue is, I think, that if you are going to go out, is to make sure, and anybody's driving, that there is a designated driver, somebody who's not consuming alcohol and who can be responsible for that. And this is a tough thing for kids to do, but if one of your friends has his car keys and wants to get behind the wheel, you got to do something to prevent that. It's a lot of responsibility on the non-drinker to do that, but the world is replete with anecdotes of the kid who said, I'm fine, got in the car, and then wrapped the car around a tree a few blocks later, or even worse, hit somebody crossing the street and then contributed to the death of another human being.
So you work at one of those university healthcare centers as a pediatrician, and the student comes in. Do you bring up the topic of unprotected sex and the implications of that?
Yes, we do it in our own adolescent clinic here, especially as part of the preparation for for college. We talked to...
So what do you tell him?
Well, we tell him, we warn about the risks of unprotected sex, that even though people get confused, they think, well, I'm on a birth control pill, so I can't get pregnant. That's not the big issue. I mean, it's a big issue getting pregnant, but it's a bigger issue. Sexually transmitted diseases, HIV is out there, gonorrhea, syphilis, they're all still present. So we certainly stress to them it's not that we're condoning, you know, premarital sex or whatever, but we're recognizing we live in a real world where that's going to happen. So we want people to be aware of the risks, because in some instances, as I said earlier, a lot of times parents are very uncomfortable bringing this up with the kids. So it may be the pediatrician, particularly the ones that are experts in dealing with adolescents, we would be the first person to bring this up and point out to this young adult that these are the risks associated with certain behaviors, and say, if you're going to do this, this is the way to protect yourself.
So the unfortunate thing does happen, and they don't have protected sex, and your son or daughter come home and say, I've got some news for you. We are going to be expecting a child. neonatal screening. I mean, how important is that stuff?
That was a great segue, Phil. I got to hand it to you. Yes, totally different. We've now changed dramatically to the newborn. Many states, in fact, I was just at a meeting earlier today, New York State is kind of moving ahead as one of the leaders in the nation to do newborn screening. What that means is that when a baby comes out, a blood sample is taken from the baby and a wide variety of conditions are tested for and sent to a lab in the state of New York. There's no charge to the patient for this. Screening the common conditions, things that people have heard of like PKU, looking phenylketonuria, which is a congenital or an inherited disorder of metabolism, thyroid problems, HIV, cystic fibrosis. So the number of conditions that can be screened for is growing. The technology has gotten so much better. We're able to identify certain tests that identify an at-risk population. It's a huge problem for us, in the sense that there are false positives for the screening test. So you get a test back. We have to, again, track down where the child is and through their pediatrician and parents, get them back in so that we can then do the definitive test to rule it in or rule it out. And then there are even false negatives where somebody may have a screening test, it's negative, but because of the circumstances, the test was inappropriately negative, then the child can be missed and slip through the cracks. So while it's a good thing, it also creates significant stresses on the healthcare system to make sure that every baby who's screened, that the results get back from the state, that they get to the right person taking care of the baby, and then you're able to follow up on the information.
I was just sitting here wondering, have you ever had a patient that came back to you 20 years later and said, you know, I'm going into medicine and you made it happen?
You know, I don't think so. Maybe they just slipped away from the... That's an interesting question. I don't think so. Hopefully there's somebody out there. My daughter, my oldest daughter, is a pediatrician and a pulmonary doctor. She's in her second year of fellowship at the University of North Carolina. So in terms of having an influence on someone, I guess that's probably the best.
So did you avoid talking to her about medicine and she went into it, or was there always an influence?
I think it was always there. We can't remember. In fact, it was interesting. She was asked a question during one of her medical school interviews. Well, what do you do if you don't get into medical school? And she came to me after the interview and she said, no, I really blew that interview. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, they asked me what I would do if I didn't get into medical school. And she said, I told them I didn't know. I had no idea, because this was the only thing that I ever wanted to do. Some people accuse me of being not cynical enough that my daughter went into medicine with all the problems that you and I both know facing medicine this day. The fact that our oldest daughter chose medicine was, people reflected that we did have a pretty positive view of this career. I've always seen it as the greatest job that you could have. So she's out there doing that. And then the real treat was that she announced that she wanted to go into pulmonary disease. I was somewhat taken aback by that. I hadn't seen that coming. So I think we're probably one of the few father-daughter combinations of both pediatrics and lung disease that I know of around. There are people whose kids have gone into medicine, but in the exact same specialty and going on is pretty unique these days.
Well, that's a marvelous testament. What motivates you every morning when you get up?
Oh, I think in this, my new job as the chair, I think it's the fact that we're around this next generation of kids, doctors, that we're involved in training them. I think that's probably the best part, as you do. I go, every morning I go to what's called Morning Report, where the residents and medical students gather and they talk about the kids that are in the hospital, and I sit in with that and get to spend time with them, because most of our day, as you know, is spent in a lot of other meetings, but that's the best part. And then I still do pulmonary medicine from time to time. They still allow me to see patients, and there's still a rush of dealing with kids who have chronic lung problems and the like.
Well, getting into that, training of young doctors, you're in a business where, sometimes you've got some pretty bad news to give to both the family and to the child. How do you train your doctors how to do that? Or is that something that's inherent?
Well, it's not inherent, and I think that's an important area to do, and it's role modeling becomes important. When I was doing a primarily pulmonary disease, we had some pretty ugly diseases there that we had to deal with. So we would make sure that the residents and fellows were with us when we broke the news to the family, and they could see what happened. And then over time, what we did, which was probably the most challenging thing, was to allow them to be the ones to break the news, to make sure they were prepared, for them to sit down with the family and tell them what was going to go on and what were going to be the outcomes, and help them through the process. So some people come to it just very easily. They're very comfortable with that role and communicating. Others, it's more of a struggle, and you have to help them through it.
Do you think compassion is a learnable thing, or is that, again, something that...
I guess you can learn a little bit, but I think you're either you got it or you don't. I think certain people just feel for other people, are able to deal with it in a very sensitive manner, and realize when they're delivering bad news that this is going to be a devastating thing for a family that they're going to have to deal with for a long time.
Well, again, it's been a distinct pleasure to have Dr. Gerald N. Laughlin, the Nancy C. Padvano Professor and Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. He is the world's authority on pulmonary disease, and as you can see, he has a breadth of knowledge in the management of pediatric disease. I hope that this information has been helpful to you in getting your children ready for school. Thank you.